9 a.m., the day after Election Day, November 7th, 2012. You're listening to Good Morning Atlanta, sponsored by World Trade Center Atlanta on Business Radio X, a proud 2012 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at atlantadowntown.com. I'm Dana Barrett.
And I'm Elizabeth Gordon.
And we have an interesting show lined up for you today. We're going to do things a little bit differently because it's the day after Election Day. We're not going to do a bunch of headlines that have to do with like stocks being up and housing being down or, you know, my favorite lists and crazy banter. We're just going to say Obama wins.
Right. Well, there's been so much uncertainty in the business community based on these election results. And so we know we're going to be talking about it a lot over the coming weeks, all of the implications and ramifications.
Exactly. We've talked about things on some of our shows here at the station about the fiscal cliff that's coming up, potentially, you know, about the economy in general. And all of that is going to be shifting and changing now that it's been decided. So we hope, and I'm going to steal a phrase from our esteemed guest, we hope everyone does not have too bad of an election hangover, but we're glad you're joining us this morning. And with that, I do want to get to our serious topic today because this is not something that we do very often, but we're going to have two guests in the studio. We have one right now from Partners Against Domestic Violence, which is obviously a more serious topic than what we do normally, but an important one, I think. And so Megan Fulmer is joining us, and Megan is the president and CEO of Partners Against Domestic Violence. I panicked there for a second with the name.
It's actually Partnership. You almost got it exactly right.
Partnership Against Domestic Violence. Okay. Thank you for correcting me. I've only had
mouthful.
One cup of coffee so far. So, you know, still working on my morning energy. But you guys just had a conference about a month ago focusing on domestic violence and how it affects the workplace.
We did. We had that on October 10th at the Home Depot corporate office.
And you had some pretty big corporate sponsors.
We had an amazing lineup that day. For the first time ever, we did a leadership or a C-suite breakfast, and that was actually keynoted by the CFO of the Home Depot, Carol Tomei. And so to have somebody of that level shine a light on what happens in the workplace is pretty spectacular. And then she was followed up by the senior vice president of Verizon, head of HR coming out of New Jersey, and then it was closed by Carrie Conan, the president of Kaiser Georgia. So we really, for the morning breakfast, we were able to put together quite a slate of heavy hitters to talk about how important this cause is. And it's the cause that nobody feels very comfortable talking about.
Yeah, and that's why we're talking about it, because we love to
so
do things
you.
That nobody else wants to do. But before we get too heavily into the topic and more of what went on at the conference and just what you guys are doing in general, first of all, we should say that Linda Boatwright is on her way here. She had a little bit of a traffic situation this morning, and she is from Kaiser Permanente, Georgia, and also on the board.
She is.
For PADV. And hopefully she'll come wandering in here shortly, so we'll bring her into the conversation. But before we, I said again, as before we get too far into it, I want to talk about you specifically and how you ended up involved in this organization.
I don't think my journey has been a typical one. I actually spent most of my career in the for-profit sector and moved to Atlanta about 14 years ago as a sales marketing director for a television station. And through some personal things, I actually lost a sister about 10 years ago. It kind of made me look at my life and say, okay, at the end of this journey, where do I want to be? And I didn't want to be adding, sorry, to somebody else's bottom line. I really wanted to be able to look at a person, an individual, a group of people, and feel like I had an impact. And so I started my nonprofit career about 10 years ago and came to this organization about 2 years ago as the vice president of development, and was very lucky that about 10 months ago, the board appointed me president and CEO. So first time for me learning all kinds of new things, because as one of my board members who's a CEO of another organization said, there's just more zeros behind the numbers I manage, but the problems and the issues that you deal with are just the same, whether that's renegotiating employee benefits, which I've gotten to do for the first time in my career, or working on a bridge loan for a new facility we're building. So it has been a very interesting journey to get there, but I'm having a great time.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your career transition, just because I think there are a lot of people. Well, first of all, with the economy being what it is, I think there are a lot of people in transition looking to switch from one type of work to another, one industry to another, like you did, for-profit to nonprofit, things like that. So,
but also even with the meaning aspect.
Absolutely.
And the, what am I really here to do? And how am I leaving my mark on the grander design and really executing on what is possible for me?
Right. And I think even though we're – I'm going to – be just, this is sad, but I'm not that young anymore, sadly. But I think that is a little bit of the influence of the millennials on us, right? On the slightly less millennial people
having
in the room.
A broader type of goal orientation,
I
right?
Think
it's
younger,
not just about money and a retirement plan.
Yeah, I think we were, I mean, I personally can't speak for you young ladies in the room, but I came up in the 80s, you know, in Wall Street times, you know, when it was like, get on the ladder, climb as high as you can, make as much money as you can. And if you don't seem to have a soul and while that's all happening, that's quite all right. Souls are overrated. You know, so that's kind of how I was brought up. Make as much money as you can. And the rest is whatever. If you happen, if you can give to charity on the side while you're making all that money,
great.
Or as you said, adding to someone else's bottom line, wonderful. But if not, man, who cares? But the younger people, and not just the millennials, but you know, I think the people in their 20s right now, maybe early 30s, and the youngsters. I mean, I have a daughter that's 20, and I know they have a much different attitude. They really do want to give back, and as Pollyanna-ish as it might sound to somebody like me, you know, sort of make the world a better place. So with all of that said, did you find the transition difficult?
I really didn't. I think what the transition part that's difficult is for people who've been in the nonprofit sector for a really long time, because I can't tell you how many times people who've done nothing but work for nonprofits say, well, you're running it like a business. Okay. It is a business. We're just not in business to make a ton of money. But we are in business to make more money than we spend so that we can have money in reserve. So the next time the economy takes a dip, I don't lay people off and cut programs. So to me, that wasn't the hard transition. And I think what you're seeing in the nonprofit sector more and more is, let's say 20 or 25 years ago, they would take someone who ran the program and promote them to a CEO position. And at the end of the day, while that's fantastic, they may not have the skills necessary to fundraise or to manage a board. And at the end of the day, those are the two most important responsibilities that you have, is making sure that you can make payroll and making sure that there's enough money to pay for the programs and services that you want to deliver. And so I think that started changing about 10 or 15 years ago. And I think that's it's a very fine balance for some people, because, you know, there's some people who are so passionate about the cause that they don't want to think there's a business aspect of it. But at the end of the day, it's no different from a for-profit business at all, except for a little bit difference on some of the forms we have to file for our taxes anymore.
Right. And I mean, you have some, obviously you have some different, as you said, goals.
Yes.
When you look at your mission and you look at your goals for the coming years, it's not about increasing your bottom line or providing more shareholder value and things like that.
No.
However, you're right. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're not bringing in more than you put out, you're going to go away.
Correct.
And that's pretty straightforward. So you're right. I mean, I think those management skills are critical. Do you have any advice for someone who is wanting to go from the for-profit world into the nonprofit world, just maybe about how they should position themselves or what the best way to sort of make that entree is?
You know, I think Atlanta has a very rich nonprofit community. And funny, I was just talking about this last night at dinner. We have so many national nonprofits that are based here. And so I think one of those first steps, if you're interested, is to volunteer, because you may want to find a cause that most closely aligns with what your personal goals are, your personal passions. I think it makes it much easier to sell it and to get involved when you do that. But the same token, it also depends on your skill set. There's not a skill set that you would have in the for-profit world that's not needed in the not-for-profit world. You know, we always are looking for CFOs or finance people. We're always looking for development people. And at the end of the day, if you're good in sales in the for-profit world, you're going to be great at sales in the not-for-profit world. It's the same skill sets that are there, which is being willing to pick up the phone, being able to manage a relationship, saying thank you, treating people well. So I don't think it's that hard of a transition. I think the larger nonprofits have been much more savvy about it. So you start looking at like the American Cancer Society and the American Heart Association. They are doing much more hiring of people with those for-profit backgrounds. And I think it's taken some of the smaller nonprofits a little bit more time to get there. But as their boards become very strong. I mean, like my board, 25 board members, it's very corporate. And so when they looked to replace the last CEO, I think they looked and said, okay, we need to change the skill set of what we've had. Great person in the job before, but much more of a programmatic background than what I might have. And I think you can hire the programmatic skill. And I rely heavily on my VP of programs, but you can't hire the business acumen.
Right. Right. You've got to get out there and get that experience. Yeah. Interesting. All right. So let's talk, let's segue. I have a perfect segue. So you're talking about corporate skills like, you know, CFO, CEO, et cetera. Sales and marketing. You mentioned that domestic violence is one of those things nobody really wants to talk about. So how do you sell and market that as an organization? Can you like
thanks.
That segue?
Lovely. Probably the hardest question I'll have all day.
That's right.
I think there's a couple of different ways that you go about that. For me, in this particular example, because we just came off our domestic violence in the workplace conference, it's selling it from a business perspective. And when you're going to talk to business owners and a CEO or a CFO, it's like, how does it affect their bottom line? And so for me, it's gathering the facts that back up your case. So for example, domestic violence costs U.S. companies $8.3 billion a year.
Amazing.
In lost productivity, days off from work, and healthcare costs. I mean, so if you put it in the words that they are going to best understand, and you're taking a volunteer in there that they like and respect that may be in a similar field. I mean, I think that's the same thing that you do in business. It's who you know, how the door gets opened, and making sure you have a business case, and then I'm not going in there and selling it as a charity or another good cause. There's millions of great causes in this organization. Why would I support this charity over another one, which will be either I'm personally invested or it makes sense for my business? And in a lot of our cases, it is about making sense for their business.
Yeah. Which is different, I think, than, well, I think anything that's health related, you could probably look at that
you
angle.
Can.
But it's an extra, you know, people, I think, don't have a problem necessarily talking about cancer.
Right.
You know, there's some billboard campaign that I haven't focused that much on. I think it's about lung cancer, maybe,
right,
where it's like blaming the victim, sort of saying, oh, you think of lung cancer as your own fault because you smoked or whatever. And I don't know if you've seen it. It's like on the bus. You listen, MARTA bus rider, you should be all over this because the posters are on the MARTA bus kiosk. What do you call those? The little stands, you know, outside mm-hmm. to protect you from the rain, whatever they're called. I'm having problems today. But anyway, so yeah, they're like crazy aunt whatever has lung cancer and you blame it on crazy aunt whatever because she smoked. Yeah. But really there's so many, the point of the poster is that there are so many forms of lung cancer that are not anyone's fault. That's just like another cancer and you should stop blaming the people that have it and help them, right? And so I think in a way domestic violence is a similar thing in that it's like you don't want to talk about it. Well, I think there's a lot of and this is, I am obviously not an expert, but just from, you know, the after school specials I watched, you know, there's a lot of guilt about from the victim's standpoint. There's a lot of shame involved with being a victim of domestic violence. And so it's not something that people readily talk about.
It's not.
There's probably a lot of lying going on, I would imagine, when you do need to take off from work and even to yourself. I mean, not even just lying to your boss, but
It takes a long time to get there. I mean, but I think the statistics speak for themselves. I mean, because we talk a lot about breast cancer. We talk a lot about different kinds of cancer. We talk a lot about heart disease. But here's something that affects 1 in 4 women. And I'm not even talking about emotional abuse at all. I'm talking about the worst forms of physical abuse. So being hit, punched, kicked. I mean, because if you added an emotional abuse, the number may escalate to 1 in 3 or 1 in 2, which
say,
is frightening.
Like 100% if you talk about emotional abuse, at least at some point in your life, right?
Exactly. Well, it's
terrible.
And as I would say, you know, I think sometimes the physical abuse is easier to recover from than the emotional abuse, because if you've been with someone who's told you, and I mean, I hate to say it, I don't have a friend who we haven't shared a story of a boyfriend who told us we were fat or unattractive or that we weren't good enough. And really, I mean, that's acceptable. And the thing is, as females, is often we internalize that because we think, oh, if this person loves me, they must be telling the truth. And, you know, we let that affect our own self-esteem. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of things that wrap up into it. And I think the biggest issue that we face is people think it's a certain socioeconomic background. And that's just absolutely not true. I mean, literally, I was on the phone probably about a week ago with a woman who left her husband, was living in Sugarloaf Country Club. You know, it doesn't get any better, more expensive than that. And, you know, it was a bigger, in some ways, fall from grace because, you know, driving the Mercedes in the multi-million dollar house.
Right.
And when you are married to a man with power, he gets you off for everything, which means you walk out of the house, the credit cards are cut off, your access to the bank account is cut off. He may be friends with the police or the district attorney, and it becomes even more difficult to navigate that whole system.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's almost harder, maybe. I mean, maybe not. I think it's hard no matter who you are.
Absolutely.
But I always joked about, I mean, I'm off on a tangent here, but I always joked about the people that make it big in show business, and either they're related to somebody who already made it big in show business, or they had nothing to lose.
Right.
You know, when you, back in the day, you remember Roseanne Barr or mm-hmm. whatever, she came from a trailer park. So
right.
she could put it all on the line and go out there and try to be a comedian because she had nothing to lose, right? So in a way, it's a similar type of thing. If you're sort of coming from a situation where you're not giving up the Mercedes and the credit cards, and you know, it might be a little easier to actually go to a shelter and seek help. Whereas if you're in that fancy suburb and you've got all those fancy friends and all that, all the trimmings, it's hard to admit it.
And it's overreported. If you look at the lower socioeconomic background, they're more likely to pick up the phone and call 911 or call the police. Whereas if you're living in Buckhead and some of the other locations, I mean, and I'm saying this, I'm also a survivor. Do you think I was going to ever pick up the phone and call the cops? No, I was fortunate enough to have a great family that I picked up the phone and said, I need to move out and I need your help. And here's what's been going on. But it took even me, it took 4 years. So it's not easy. And it takes most women 7 times before they finally leave.
Wow.
And when they leave, they're at a far greater risk of being killed. So you decide to leave and your likelihood of being murdered skyrockets to 75%.
Oh my God.
So, and women do know that. So it's like, okay, usually the breaking point becomes when the abuse moves from them to the children.
Yep.
And then it's like, okay, I might be able to put up with it for me and not put up with it, but I'm not saying that lightly. But once it moves to the children, it's like, okay, this is the breaking point and you're not going to touch our kids.
Right.
And that's when we see them come to us. I mean, we run the only 2 state-certified domestic violence shelters, one in the city of Atlanta and one in Gwinnett County, and we can house at any time 72 women and children. But more than 50% of those we serve are children, if that gives you any idea of what it's like when they come to us. And they come to us, you guys, with nothing but possibly the clothes on their back and maybe one bag and, like, holding on to a teddy bear, and often in the middle of the night. So, you know, they are coming to us with nothing, and we work with them to rebuild their lives, which is an amazing, amazing thing.
So before we go too far away from that, and I know I want to come back to this multiple times during the course of our time together, but if anyone listening needs this kind of assistance and help, how do they find you?
The easiest way is to go online, which is www.padv.org. And there's online resources, and then both of our crisis lines are listed on there as well, so that our crisis lines operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so even if it is you need someone to talk to and you're not ready to leave, we have trained advocates who are there to talk to you and listen to you. And if you need resources like community counseling or anything else to help you on your journey and you don't need shelter, we can provide that as well. So okay. Sometimes it's even for, you know, family, friends who are around the victim who are often confused about what to say or do, and we can give them advice, because, you know, a lot of what happens is, well, why don't you just leave? It's the last thing you need to be saying. If it was just that easy, she would have already done it.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of the conversation is about being supportive, and so that the door is open when she finally makes that decision that she wants to leave, that she does feel like she has family and friends who are not going to judge her. Because that's the scariest part as a victim, is that your family and friends are going to judge you.
Yeah.
And as women, we're often the worst on each other. I mean, you even look, like, nationally, what was it? The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. One of them came and told her friends that she was being abused, and nobody believed her.
Yeah.
Jeez. How awesome. You know, I finally get up the guts to tell my close friends I'm going through this. And often we're so good at hiding it that, of course, the bruises aren't necessarily on the face, because the abuser, as they get better, they're going to do them in places that are easy to cover up. And to then have that judgment passed on you is it makes it very difficult.
Well, it's funny. I think that women in general, like, you know, whether it's violence or any kind of sort of relationship failure, I think we are reluctant to talk about it, because we sort of put all our eggs in this is a great relationship basket. And then, you know, you sort of have to come forward and admit that it didn't work for whatever reason. And I remember, you know, I have not been a victim of domestic violence, thank God, knock on wood, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when I got divorced, I remember, you know, when the relationship went bad, not telling anybody. And I tell everybody everything. I am like, anybody who listens to the show, like, knows my whole life story, because I'll just share everything. But when something, I think, even though I didn't use that word with myself, I was ashamed that it didn't work and that, you know, I had done something that was, you know, stupid or whatever. And so when I finally did say, okay, that's it, I'm getting a divorce, and I went and told my father, my father said, "Are you sure you want to do that? He's such a great guy." Are you sure? And I was like, "Really, Dad? That is just not even remotely helpful. Really? That is just, please.
Because I've agonized to get here. Thanks right. so much."
Right. So even worse when it's something like that, you know, mm-hmm. when it's, you know, you're, it's literally a life and death situation. And to have your support people not support you and not believe you is just unfathomable.
And, you know, some of that's cultural issues and some of those are religious issues as well. And we really try to work very closely with, you know, with some of the churches, because some of the churches very much do promote that you don't leave your marriage.
No matter what.
No matter what. And we have a great supporter, church supporter out in Gwinnett, 12 Stone. And I was talking to the CFO and he said it best. He's like, "Sometimes you have to get up off your knees." And I was like, very astute. He was like, "Because we would never tell a woman if she was in that situation that she needed to stay." And so, you know, for us, it's then equipping clergy, rabbis with this, the right scriptures if they're going to talk about it, because that is one of the biggest barriers for women leaving is often their religious beliefs.
So, Megan, a big part of the mission of PADV is to educate people around domestic violence. So, I mean, we've been talking about it for 20 minutes now. We haven't really defined what domestic violence is. Can you give us kind of a definition and then tell us how you educate people around?
Sure. Well, we've expanded the definition. It's really now intimate partner violence, because it affects same-sex couples at the same rate as it does male and female. And in fact, in this day and age, it's now 1 in 7 men who are abused. So it's very interesting to watch the progression. But intimate partner violence is defined really as using power or wanting to exert power or control over another individual. And that doesn't always have to be physical. It can be emotional. It can be economic. You know, we have a spokesperson who speaks for us, and her husband would literally take her paycheck the minute she walked in the house on payday and give her no access to money. It's, you know, the systematic maybe cutting you off from your family and friends. I mean, you know, we even do a lot of education with parents and teens, because you think about technology. Well, if your son or daughter is getting 100 texts a day from their significant other, there's probably a problem there. And you need to be able to open that dialogue up to have the conversation, because, you know, that's one of the things that we see is, like, we were doing a survey, 81% of parents don't think that teen dating violence is a problem, yet the stats for teens are worse than they are for women. It's 1 in 3 teens. So doesn't happen, and it's not my kid. But it's 1 in 3. And then,
so it's somebody's kid.
It's somebody's kid.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if what we say to parents is, if the relationship happens very quickly, if they start isolating them from their friends, wanting to spend just all of their time with them and not letting them see longtime friends, kind of isolating them from their family, a lot of controlling behaviors, and that's probably the time for you to start having that conversation about what a healthy relationship looks like. Because if you start that pattern at that age, if you look at women who end up being killed, their relationships with their abuser started between the ages of 16 and 24.
Wow.
And that is the time when you are forming the biggest part of your idea of what relationships are. I mean, we do an annual teen summit, and ours is coming up February 3rd of 2013. And last year I was sitting next to 2 13-year-old girls, and one said to the other, "I thought if he hit you, that meant he loved you."
Oh, Lord.
And I went, but if you're seeing it at home, and you think about it, 1 in 4 women, and let's say the average household has 2 kids, so little boy and little girl are seeing it, you know, they can be up to 1,500% more likely to become abused themselves and become an abuser. So if we aren't starting to educate our kids outside of the home about what a healthy relationship looks like, I think those statistics are going to get far worse than the 1 in 4 we see now.
So I want to just reiterate that definition. So it's exerting power and control over your partner that is considered domestic violence. So even if it's not physical, I think that's really interesting, because I think a lot of people probably experience some form of that and don't even realize that that's what it is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's interesting when we talk about the economic impact, and you're measuring the economic impact of sick days or healthcare costs, that kind of thing. But there's this whole other economic impact that you can imagine of a woman's self-esteem or a person's self-esteem. And if you're coming into the office having been through this experience at home or told that you're not good enough or had somebody dominate you in some way, then you're not really able to show up as much of an employee or as much of an economic impact at work as you really could be.
Absolutely.
So there's even a bigger issue that you can't even define unless you really dig deep on this.
And that's part of the training that we do in workplace, because, you know, a lot of these women start off and they're extremely productive members of the workplace. And if you start seeing performance suffer, you know, I think the knee-jerk reaction from an employer's perspective is, okay, let's put them on a performance improvement plan and let's move them out, where there may be something else going on there. And the one thing that we know is if a woman is not able to support herself, she can't leave. So if she loses her job because of performance, she's never going to be able to leave and be able to move on with her life. And so going back to the conference we had in October was creating a workplace environment where it's okay to disclose, and not just to disclose, but to get help. And, you know, that there is some kind of policy in place that gives some parameters for days off in case you need to get a temporary protective order, days off if you have to have custody hearings. And so that if, and linking to organizations like Partnership Against Domestic Violence, because it's not every EAP is equipped to deal with domestic violence. And you really do want your employees to have access to experts. But it's not even just the employee that it affects. If you survey the workplace, everybody around that employee knows what's going on. Whether it's the significant other calling the workplace repeatedly, and then if his wife or girlfriend's not answering, guess what? Then he starts calling the other employees. So you're not even talking about lost productivity from the victim. You're talking about lost productivity all right, around the environment. Exactly, the whole department. And I mean, then you literally put a whole department actually at risk, because if that violence escalates, guess where most of those deaths occur? At the workplace.
Yeah. So now, what was the response from, or what is the response from some of the big corporations about sort of embracing this environment and this culture? Because I think, you know, again, with my sidetracks, but, and just to, you know, lighten things up a bit, I'm going to give another example that is ridiculous and has nothing to do with domestic violence. But when there's somebody in the workplace, for example, that's stinky because they don't bathe or they don't do their clothes, nobody wants to tell them.
Absolutely not.
Maybe they'll go to HR and say, you know, Joe's a little stinky. Can someone do something about it?
Right.
And the HR person also doesn't want to do anything about it, because they're still, even though that's their quote unquote, maybe their job, they're still a human being. And it's horrible to have to go up to somebody and say, you are stinky and you need a shower, or please wash your clothes. Here's some detergent. But so obviously this is, you know, again, I'm making light, but this is another situation in which even if the company from the top says this is something that we do care about and that we are sensitive to and that we are willing to provide those days off, how do you create a culture among your employees where people can talk freely, right, or feel comfortable talking to the person they think might be a victim, or having the victim be able to go to their boss, right, and not feel that they're not going to get a promotion or whatever?
Well, you know, I will use a quote from Martha Delahunty from Verizon. She said, I'd rather be early and wrong than late and right. I mean, and if you think about that, of all the times that we could have had a conversation,
right,
and it had the worst outcome.
Right.
And in Verizon's example, they did have the worst outcome. They are a national supporter of domestic violence because they lost somebody who was an employee, and it made them really look at their policies and want to be more proactive about it. And so it's training down to the front line so that you know, training your frontline managers, creating awareness. I mean, if you think about it, we sit through sexual harassment training, right?
Right, of course.
We often sit through workplace violence training, right? But how much simpler would it be if we also added this as part of that workplace violence training, is a piece on domestic violence? Because then if we are educating every employee, which is hope, you know, what my long-term goal is for our organization is to make this conference a national conference and to be able to evolve it so that we're doing continued online training. Because the more access that we can give companies to the tools that they need so they're not reinventing the wheel or having to create it, I think the more system-wide changes that we can have. I mean, I can only serve 584 women and children in my shelters, but if I can get Home Depot to put a corporate policy in place, I protect 300,000 employees.
Right.
And so to me, you kind of got to do both, which is you got to do the big systems changes, which is working with corporations and the and having the shelter open for people who have to get out of there now.
Yeah.
But we won't see I would love for the shelters to go away, but we're not going to see that till we see the big system-wide changes.
And I think it's also important to note that while I think, it's great that some of the bigger companies are hopefully starting to be aware of this and, try to embrace it, even if it's just because of the cost savings that they hopefully will have.
That's fine with me.
Exactly. Whatever the reason. But I have worked for a lot of mid-size and small businesses, and I think everybody sort of feels that in order for the economy to improve, small businesses have to play a big part, as do sort of the medium size. I guess it depends on what you define as small and medium. But they seem to be almost the places, the small businesses often, I think, are very sensitive, and huge businesses can be very sensitive. It's the ones in the middle that sort of don't spend the time and money on doing programs, educating people, even on the ones that you normally hear about, sexual harassment and all of those things, because they're so focused on their bottom line and on improving shareholder value and all of that. And they don't want to, quote unquote, waste time on things like that. That I almost feel like I've worked for very, very tiny little companies, four people, and huge companies like Georgia Pacific. And they were both pretty good. But it's those middle companies, 100 person, 300 person, that I think almost struggle the most. Do you have a way to sort of reach out to those types of companies?
We do. And in fact, we will come in and do on-site training and for a very minimal cost so that, if that's something that they want to outsource, we have the trained staff who can come in and do that for them. So as long as they can provide us with a conference room, we can bring in, the computer, all of the materials and train their employees. So, that is something that we absolutely have the ability to do and do, probably hundreds of times every single year.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's going to always, I think that's a tough challenge because, like I said, those businesses and also those businesses are still so dependent on the personalities that run them. If it's all male, they might be less sensitive to that. Or, heaven knows, I'm sure, as you mentioned, that domestic violence sort of doesn't have economic boundaries and socioeconomic borders. And so I'm sure there's some corporate executives who are among the abusers, we hate to say, and they're going to be pretty resistant to having those types of programs in their workplace, I would think.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I won't use the company name, but I was at probably a Fortune 20 company having a discussion with their CIO. And he says, it doesn't happen here. And his head of HR was in the room with me. And she said, we just had a murder here 2 weeks ago. And it was related to domestic violence. It does happen here. And it happened in our executive office. Yeah. And it was I didn't even have to say anything. I was like, yep.
Yeah.
I mean, so I think there's just some of that goes on. That's like not here, everywhere else, but not in our office. And I think the reality is it's like, yeah, it's happening in your office too.
Yeah, it's everywhere. I mean, you can't have one in four and say it doesn't happen here. That's ridiculous. Okay. So joining us in the studio, Linda Boatwright, welcome.
Thank you so much.
We're so happy to have you here. We're glad you made it.
Thank you.
Plenty of time to spare. We've got plenty of time to harass you, so it's all good.
Great.
Linda is the Director of Employee and Labor Relations at Kaiser Permanente, Georgia, and she was the 2012 Domestic Violence in the Workplace Conference Chair and also on the Board of Directors for PADV, and made it here through traffic and through some scheduling confusion.
But I'm here.
But you're here, and that's all that really matters.
Yes.
So,
Linda, why don't you tell us more about yourself and how you got involved in the organization?
Certainly. I have been with Kaiser for about 3 years now. And in 2010, I, along with several leaders at Kaiser, attended the Workplace Violence Conference. And later that year, we decided to have PADV come out and run an awareness session, and they did, with many of our frontline managers. And I will tell you that less than 48 hours from their presentation, we had our first domestic violence case. And over the next several months, we had upwards of 7 or 8 cases of domestic violence.
Was that because the conference happened and people were aware?
It was because
were more or less afraid to come forward?
It was because of the training that we had taken our supervisors through, which was, again, that awareness piece. So many times domestic violence is occurring in the workplace and you don't know it. But we were able, through PADV's efforts, to equip our managers with the knowledge and the skills to be able to recognize domestic violence. So when a woman may come in with more makeup than she's ever worn, or when she's getting constant calls, or when she's tweeting, and those are the subtle things that you look for. But that was our experience, and I was so taken with the work that PADV had done and was afforded the opportunity to join the board. It's an opportunity to give back to the organization as well as help my company deal with a very quiet but very real matter.
Now, Megan was telling us a bit about the conference. I'd like to hear your perspective as well, especially as terms of organizing and putting together. What were some of the goals going into it, and what really were the results that you felt came out of it?
We were very pleased with the outcome. And early on, we decided that we would change the focus slightly for this year's conference. In the past, we had focused primarily on the victim. And we wanted to stay true to that, but in the same vein, we wanted to be able to tell the business story around domestic violence. Companies spend upwards of $8.3 billion a year on domestic violence in the workplace, and they don't even know it. And so we focused on the business. We framed the conference around three key components: awareness, education, and action. We started the morning with a leadership breakfast, which encompassed many of the CEOs and their direct staffs attending a leadership breakfast that was designed to, again, speak to the impact of domestic violence. Carol Tomei, Chief Financial Officer for Home Depot, was our keynote speaker. We had speakers from both Kaiser and both Verizon who participated, and we had upwards of 80 leaders in that breakfast. That was a first for us. The conference then encompassed, again, an expert panel that was represented by both Kaiser, Prudential, and again, Verizon. We also did a presentation by Sketchworks that spoke to, again, the dynamics of domestic violence and how it impacted an up-and-comer within the workplace. It was a play, if you will, a vignette. In essence, the most interesting thing about what we did this year, we put together a online toolkit that participants can now link back into through the PADV site that gives them the tools and the techniques and material to help them then develop their domestic violence policies, speaks to actions that they can take. Many times we go to conferences, we get binders, and we never look at them again. But this team, and I must say it was a team effort, literally put together something that I think will last year after year. So we were very pleased. We had about 125 participants in this year's conference.
I've been thinking as we've been talking this morning about a cure, if you will, because when we talk about cancer and we talk about heart disease and some of these other things, we're always talking about finding a cure. So we have multiple things that we're doing, as nonprofits that are supporting whatever the cause is. So for example, in cancer, we might be doing patient care. We might be trying to do things to help the person who is the quote unquote victim, but we're also trying to stop cancer. We're trying to have a cure. And, this is such an interesting case because, the victim, we obviously want to help the victim get out. First of all, acknowledge that they're in that situation, to not feel personal blame, to understand that this is a widespread problem and that it's not their fault and that they can come forward, hopefully get the support from their family and friends and workplace and all of that. But the underlying problem is somebody else that's doing something bad. So I guess my question is, can we do anything about that? And what can we do?
I think it I think it does start with the kids. And I mean, if you look at it, the state of Georgia actually does have a policy that mandates teen dating violence prevention education in the classroom. Guess what? It ain't getting done. And, you know, because we want to spend all this time on math and science, which are really important. But guess what, guys? If you see abuse going on at home and you're nervous all the time, do you think the kids are equipped for math or science or English if it's going on in probably 25% of the households? Do you see what I'm saying? And so what we do know, and I mean, and statistics bear out on this, is if we can start working with the kids at those ages of 11, 12, and 13, even if they're seeing it at home, we can educate them. And, you know, through, and we typically try to do it peer to peer, because at the end of the day, gosh, we'd love to believe that our kids listen to us. And yes, we have a lot of influence, but guess what? Anymore, it's their peers that have that influence. And so we really work to put, and Kaiser is a huge supporter of this, a 6-week in-school curriculum where there's a pre-test and a post-test. And we really work on everything from what a healthy relationship looks like to, if you're a bystander, how you intervene in a way that you don't jeopardize yourself, and standing up and saying, it's not okay to do this. You know, so I think it's going to take a whole community effort around the education piece to get us there. And so, for example, one of the national programs Verizon does is actually with college and high school coaches, so that the coaches are talking to their players about these behaviors are not okay. Yeah. But until we get men involved in the conversation as well, mm-hmm. standing up as role models mm-hmm. to say, this is not acceptable, and as a man, I'm going to hold you accountable for mm-hmm. doing the right thing, and I'm going to stand up and do the right thing. It really is a conversation on many different levels, and we know in areas where they've really focused on both the teen education, getting men involved, and making it a comfortable conversation both in the workplace and, you know, around the coffee table. Think about how breast cancer awareness started in the 80s. It's because we told women, this is something that's going to kill you, and it's 1 in 8. Okay, so the conversation needs to start now. This is 1 in 4 women, and we need to make it comfortable so that if we're having our manicure or spa day, that we're talking about, here's some of the signs, and it's okay if this is going on. Let's talk about it, and what can we do to help you? But it's so taboo.
And I'll share a brief story that happened as a result of this year's conference. We invited several of our call center managers to the conference. And I got a call 2 Thursdays ago to say, you need to come over to the call center. And I went over, and everybody was dressed in purple, which is the color for domestic violence. And I bring that up only because, how do you cure it? You cure it by talking about it. You cure it by raising the awareness. And for managers to go back from that conference, to share the learnings from that conference, and then to engage their teams to the extent that they visibly did something, speaks again volumes around, when you have dialogue, you have at least the beginning of a cure to anything. And so we're very happy about
that.
Well,
and I think there's a couple of other things. I mean, one, I think it would be great if there'd be a way to transfer that shame from the woman or the man who's being abused to the abuser.
Right.
They should be ashamed of themselves. And everybody should be, I mean, I think they know that because it's obviously not something they talk about either. Mm-hmm. I go home and abuse my wife. Mm-hmm. You know, what are you doing tonight? Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that it really needs to be that the shame should be on them. And I also think, you know, as a parent, as a mother, if you're being abused, I think you do, as you mentioned earlier, Megan, that a lot of women don't actually leave until the kids start being abused. And that's when they finally say that's enough, and they take the kids and maybe come to the shelter or go seek help elsewhere. But I think if you can kind of inject into that mother's brain that even if the kids are not being physically abused, but being in that household while you are being abused is going to either turn your son or daughter into an abuser or make them more likely to be abused later, that's huge. I think that's so huge because, you know, we make all these decisions. We think we're protecting our children. And
you're not.
Yeah, you're not.
We had a gentleman come up to me. We had our candlelight vigil. We do that mm-hmm. once a year to commemorate those who've lost their lives in Georgia to domestic violence. Gentleman's probably a 45-year-old African-American man, and he came up to me and he was crying, and he said, you know, I grew up in a household where my father beat my mother. And he said, I didn't realize how much it affected me until, you know, the last few years. And he's like, and my daughter actually asked me to get counseling, not because he was an abuser, but because he's gone so polar opposite that he doesn't even take up for himself. Mm-hmm. Everybody, mm-hmm. you know, takes advantage of him because he didn't want to be like his dad, to the point, to his detriment. And so he was talking about how his daughter was the one, his 14-year-old daughter was like, Daddy, I need you to take care of yourself. And, you know, his first step was, that was the first time he had disclosed to somebody that he was a child witness and he was a child survivor. And, you know, that's the first step of the recovery process. But I mean, here's something that happened 40 years mm-hmm. ago in his life that has had that much of an impact that it's impacted his whole, the way he's led his whole life.
Yeah. It's really such a undiscussed topic that I think even for people who become abusers, you know, not that I mean, everybody's not a bad guy. So, you know, even for somebody who, oh, we're having a little phone ringing in the background. It's always fun. But, you know, they still can seek help. I think there's probably, and again, I am so not an expert here, but I think there are probably people who are abusers who feel terrible about the fact that that is who they are and don't want to be that, right. but find themselves, again, they maybe grew up with it. They have anger that they can't control, whatever the case may be. That's also not the kind of thing you're going to come forward and be like, you know, I have a little problem. I'm an abuser. Right. We're perfectly okay coming forward now and saying I'm an alcoholic or I'm mm-hmm. a drug addict. And we've taken a lot of the blame shame and away. Shame away from those diseases. And I did air quotes, but you know, I think is to come forward and say, you know what, I think I might have these abusive tendencies. I hit my wife and I feel terrible about it.
And there's a nationally recognized program in Atlanta that we have a great partnership called Men Stopping Violence. Exactly. And what they do is they work directly with the abusers on, and it's a 6-month long commitment. And they have a really good success rate. But I mean, it's a long journey from starting that first 6 months. And literally some of them actually came to our vigil because they said it was life-changing for them. They had never thought about it from the abused woman's perspective, and they were just so blown away by the emotional long-term effects that they've had on these women's lives. And, you know, while I didn't realize they were coming in, it frightened me a little bit to learn that, you know, they were far enough along in the program that I was like, okay. And if it made that much of a difference that it will help with their behavior change, okay. Okay, that makes sense.
I think the other thing to factor in is there are all types of abuse. So many times we talk about physical abuse, but I have family members who've gone through emotional abuse for 20 and 30 years from their spouse.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's another dimension that probably doesn't get talked about a lot, but it has the same impact on children and the family structure.
Absolutely. Well, and Elizabeth, you mentioned earlier when you were talking about that, you know, if someone's being emotionally abused, they might not have bruises or have extra makeup on their face, but they're coming to the workplace without the self-esteem that they should have, without the confidence in their ability to do their job, perhaps with a lack of energy, you know, and all kinds of things that are still costing the company money because they're not producing and performing at the level that they could if they weren't in that situation.
Absolutely.
Right. In addition to being such a, you know, important issue from a human standpoint, it's obviously had a huge economic impact. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's so many of these companies, big and small, getting involved now. And I'd like to find out more information about how organizations can get involved in PADV, how they can support the organization, fundraisers and that type of thing, and where they can find out more information.
I would direct anyone interested to the PADV website. It's PADV.org.
Okay.
If you go on the site, you'll see a number of tools, but I referenced earlier the tool kit that we had put together coming off of the conference. The kit is really designed, again, around, one, increasing awareness of domestic violence. So we talk about providing education to leaders and employees and taking action to include, really, the company's commitment to the cause. Something as simple as, and Verizon does this extremely well, a phone drive where you're literally giving old phones to the organization, because sometimes this is the only lifeline that a woman has. But we also, in the toolkit, it will address the facts and the myths around domestic violence. And then last but not least, some help around how you as a company might explore putting together policies, because we have sample policies in the toolkit and best practices in the toolkit. So quite frankly, that first move should be to visit the website.
Excellent.
So just for the sake of it, you said there are myths and facts around domestic violence. What is one of the big myths, would you say?
I think, I hate to say this, I hate this one, but a woman deserves what she gets. Whatever, she's part of the problem.
She did something to
justify the abuse that she's taking. And that is probably the most hateful myth that we hear.
Yeah.
It's not a myth, but it's another reality that it tends to be perpetual. If you see it in the husband, you may see it in the children. And
right.
So again, just a fact. That's a fact.
Right. And I also think from a fact standpoint, just saying again, 1 in 4 women,
right.
I think that's so important just to
right.
make people realize it's not isolated. It's
right.
really, really pervasive.
And as a leader, if you think about your organization, let's say you have 100 people that you're responsible for, 25 of those people potentially
right.
have or will experience domestic violence in their lives.
Right. It's horrible. What are the goals for the organization going forward?
That's a big question. Well,
yeah.
You know, that's a great question, and I'm excited about the future. And in February, we have been embarked on a capital campaign, which has gone exceedingly fast, knock on wood, to open in February. We will be the largest domestic violence shelter, not only in Georgia, but in the Southeast, and it will be state of the art. We're excited about it. We'll be able to go from serving 32 women and children to serving 55 women and children, and the new shelter is stunning, and it's going to be an amazing place of healing for the organization. So I think that's one exciting thing. And I think what we've learned from the conference is, how do we take what we're doing here, because really no other organization, not just in Georgia, but in the country, is doing a conference like this. How do we elevate it to a national conference, so that not only are we having Georgia companies participate, but we have companies from all over the country participating. So I think strategically looking at that, and I think the other growth that you will see from the organization is us putting more time and resources on the prevention work that we're doing with teens. I think that is absolutely mission critical for so many reasons. But I mean, that's the future. If you think about it, that's the future of our country, and we have to invest as much as we can in making sure that they are growing up to understand what a healthy relationship looks like. Because as I said earlier, schoolwork's not going to get done if they don't have a safe place to go home to, or if they're not in a good, healthy relationship.
Or if they just don't get it. I mean,
right.
frankly, you know, I mentioned that I have a 20-year-old daughter, and I remember her coming home from school, and I'm not sure she even told me about this right away. I think she told me later. One of the boys in the neighborhood that she knew probably since second grade, I think by this point they were in late middle school, early high school, still riding the school bus, maybe ninth grade or something like that, and he grabbed her chest mm-hmm. on the bus, and she sort of pushed him off and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I can do whatever I want."
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the end of it. She was like, "No, you can't." And she kind of shoved him away. So there were two sides to that. One, that she have enough self-esteem and knowledge that this is her body and no one has a right to do that if she doesn't want that. But also that he be educated.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there was domestic violence in his home. I don't think, obviously, I don't know. But I think he was just an idiot teenage boy who maybe wasn't given boundaries, who wasn't taught that he can't do whatever he wants. And in this very sort of permissive parenting sort of environment that we have, where we want to be our kid's best friend and whatever,
And everybody gets a gold star.
Everybody gets a gold star. Everybody's special. You know, really tell our kids things like that, you know, because again, we don't want to talk about it. You know, I can't imagine sitting down with my son. I didn't have a boy, so I didn't have to do this, but in saying, "You will keep your hands to yourself,"
right.
you know, unless you're 100% sure that that girl wants you or that other boy wants you to touch them.
Right.
That's a hard conversation to have. And I think whether there's domestic abuse in the house or not, kids need to be educated. The girls and boys, but everybody needs to have enough self-esteem to say no, to push somebody away, to protect themselves, to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody needs to know it's not okay to do that.
Absolutely.
So I think having that as a mission and to really reach out to teens is huge. So I really applaud you for that.
We participated last year in the Teen Violence Dating Conference, and two of our pediatric doctors participated and did a fabulous overview on just teen dating. And it was amazing how teens reacted to that. Because it does go on.
Oh, yeah.
It starts out as maybe kidding or messing around or fooling around, and it turns into something else. So PADV has done a fabulous job of just raising the awareness across the board. I will do one more paid announcement for PADV.
Please.
Amy Alvarez is the new director of programs or development. And she would be a great contact. They also, and I referenced this earlier, there is a workshop called Domestic Violence 101 that any company can reach into and have them come out and give you, they will give you the fundamentals, but they'll also give you a lot of depth around just this whole topic. So again, PADV.org, Amy Alvarez, please reach out to them because they'll do a great job for you.
Excellent. A lot of great resources. We are happy that we've had the opportunity to have this frank and honest discussion about what goes on in domestic violence and what people can do about it. And we're really just honored to have you here in the studio with us today, because we think we're so blessed here in Georgia to have an organization like PADV. And as you expand and reach more around the country, we definitely want to hear more about all the success and the great results that you're achieving. So thank you both for being here today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, I think we should definitely have you guys back either right before or right after the teen conference in February.
We'd love that.
Because,
yeah,
we would love to get more details on that. I have a special place in my heart for teens, you know. I think I still am one, maybe. It's the part of the problem. But no, you know, I really made an effort when my daughter was coming up to sort of be the quote-unquote cool mom. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I mean, I was a single mom too, so, you know, that made it easier to be cool, mm-hmm. you know. But because of that, I knew a lot of what was going on in the lives of her friends that their parents didn't know.
Right.
And so I really feel strongly about helping those girls, especially, I guess, again, because I was the mother of a daughter. You know, I feel especially sort of tied to teenage girls and wanting them to come up safely and with self-esteem and
Absolutely.
With dignity and all of those things. So I'm looking forward to hearing more about the
Absolutely.
Teen conference. And if people want to get involved in that, is that also on the website?
It is. And registration just went up yesterday. And so it is free thanks to our wonderful sponsors. But so, yes, that's at PADV.org. And get registered because spaces do go very quickly.
Awesome. Any other comments, Elizabeth, before we wrap it up?
I think that's it for today.
All right. Well, thanks again to our guests, to Megan and Linda, for joining us, and to our sponsor, World Trade Center Atlanta. You can learn more about World Trade Center Atlanta by visiting their website, which is WTCAtlanta.com. I'm Dana Barrett.
And I'm Elizabeth Gordon. You've been listening to BusinessRadioX.com, a proud 2012 member of Central Atlanta Progress. Learn more about Central Atlanta Progress at AtlantaDowntown.com. And be sure to stay tuned for more great shows here on Business Radio X. Thank you.